When the church asks publicly and authoritatively in the name of Jesus Christ that a person or object be protected against the power of the evil one and withdrawn from his dominion, it is called exorcism. Exorcism is directed at the expulsion of demons or to the liberation from demonic possession through the spiritual authority with which Jesus entrusted his church. In the Catholic ceremony of baptism, we perform an exorcism. It's not a type of exorcism or a sort of blessing. It is an exorcism, because there are two types of exorcism in the Catholic Church. The type that we perform at every baptism, and then the type we don't talk about very often.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers. The Rance Macabre. Cutting,
cultured,
and curated.
Now, we've only opted to cover two movies because we've got a lot of details on possessions and exorcisms.
There's a lot there. You know, since the beginning of people doing things, they've been exorcising people.
It's really...
There's a lot of history.
It's really strange to think of it in those terms because, I mean, you know, I've talked about being a cynic, but or a skeptic, rather. But there is so much over the course of human
history. I mean, you have to kind of think, like, maybe someone's onto something.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, if everyone who, even people who could not contact each other, all have these same things that they're dealing with,
like type stories,
maybe there's a little something there.
So going from a Kabbalah-based, turns out less based on reality type story,
right,
but one of the more traditionally Jewish fashion to the very classic Catholic exorcism.
That's right.
You've got some details as far as possessions over the course of
time. Catholic exorcism becomes kind of interesting and kind of wrapped up with the witchcraft or like that witch hunt mentality.
No,
especially
the Catholic Church against women?
What is that? Especially in Elizabethan England. There was this huge kind of witch hunt going on. But what we have in England, which is compounding some of this stuff, is a political battle between Church of England and the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church at that time, let's say in the mid-1500s, is really, if you believe in that, that's crazy stuff. It's Church of England and that's it at that particular time.
We have to draw the line somewhere.
Yeah. So there's this huge like political weight and social weight that's put on some of the stories from that time. And one that I found that was really just a bizarre tale altogether is the story of the Seven in Lancashire. And this story takes place right around the turn of the 1600s. Into the 1600s. So from 1595, and it kind of goes forward there, there were seven people in one family in Lancashire, England, that were possessed.
Okay.
That's a huge amount. However, Lancashire in England, anywhere from 1560 onto the 1620s, has the most cases of possessions.
Oh.
People just love to be possessed there.
Wow. And so on the timeline, that's Salem witch trials were around 1692, 93, right?
So this is
shortly after, but there's still like religious fervor.
Well, this is 1590.
Oh.
So this is where C of E is really starting, Church of England is really starting to take hold. And to be Catholic, that I mean, that kind of happens later in the 1600s, but to be Catholic is very similar to being like, well, you might as well be those druids, being crazy and stuff. And
those nature worshippers.
What is important about that is while the Catholics have a huge stronghold in history at this time, the stories change from when they originally happened to be a little more palatable to the Church of England. So diaries are taken, a lot of text is ruined, and accounts that people had maybe in 1595 vary by the time you get to like 1620 to make it a little more like politically less Catholic and more Church of England.
Okay.
So it kind of wrecks a lot of our historical context. So we can't exactly see what was actually going on. 1595, we have 7 kids in this household. Some are 30, but all the way down into age 9.
Okay.
That are all possessed. And it all happens really, really in a short amount of time.
7 kids.
Actually, only 6 of them are kids. One of them is actually a maid, just so you know. She's just wandered in.
Okay.
What gets awesome about this, here are some of the signs that were listed in the diaries that we do have of the accounts. There was preternatural knowledge of things, extraordinary strength. They were familiar with Latin, which apparently they shouldn't have been, but they were. One of the kids could sing really well. That was written down. One of them could mimic. She was like an impersonator.
None of these things sound bad.
Not too
bad,
right?
These are all party tricks.
Yeah, exactly. One of them, though, however, seems to have been able to see demons. All right, fine. I'll give them that, okay. Right? One of them was really, really good at spinning, like spinning yarn. Okay. That's like a godsend in like 1590s,
right? Yeah, still waiting
right?
to hear a downside.
Yeah.
Seeing demons might be a little stressful.
4 of them were really good at botany, and they were also expert dancers. So you got to watch out for the devil.
These are all the
there.
Noted like turn of events. These are the
yes.
things that they were all of a sudden, they had aptitudes for.
Well, they seem to always kind of had these like the one who could sing really well. It's not like they said he suddenly could sing really well. He's always been very good at singing.
It's starting to sound less like a family possession than just like a demo night for a family, like a mom saying like check out my kid's skills.
Exactly,
like, this
is like the Von Trapp
that
family,
one can
right?
sing really well.
And the last one, the kids were fine when they were playing. They were just normal kids, but. They would freak out when you would read scripture in their face, which why?
Yeah.
Devil,
don't,
obviously.
Don't read scripture in people's faces. That's going to freak them out.
Of
that's,
course.
That's
of
a natural
course.
Reaction.
It's like, it's really like a terrible situation. It goes kind of like this. So the father says, my kids are kind of like freaking out of these things. And he calls in John Dee. And John Dee says, well, I know this guy named Hartley. Hartley was an exorcist, very famous guy at that time, but he's kind of less on the side of exorcism, more on the side of a witch.
Oh.
And he comes to the family, and they had gone through, you know, doctors, other priests, and then we come to John Dee, and now John Dee brings Hartley in here. He also takes the kids sometimes to Manchester all by himself. I don't know, just give your kids up. Fine. Later on in Hartley's life, to fast forward to the end of it, it doesn't end well for him because he is hanged for being a fraud when he can't even recite the Lord's Prayer. So they kind of figure out, oh, hey,
maybe
ding, ding,
wasn't
ding.
Wasn't good under pressure. They put a noose around his head and tell him I guess it's at that point, it's just like, it's muscle memory. You've been saying the Lord's Prayer so long that you shouldn't even, it's not a thinking process under stress. You're just repeating.
Yeah, I mean, I think. Anyone who goes enough times into church, you know the Lord's Prayer. You're just
like
going to get hammered in your head.
Trump with Corinthians 2, that or 2 Corinthians or whatever the fuck he said that was really wrong.
So here's where the timeline gets a little interesting, and it kind of maybe informs us to a little bit of what else goes on, right?
Okay.
In 1565, there's a separate woman, not part of the 7 of Lancashire, and her name is Anne Milner. She knows Hartley beforehand and now suddenly is possessed. She's possessed in a way where she stops eating and her stomach swells. And she is exercised in a very interesting way in that they have 10 people in the community praying around her in this exorcism. Her stomach is...
Like the Jewish tradition. The
exactly.
Tradition, the
exactly. Yeah. They're praying and pushing on her stomach, which is swollen right now. What we can read from the diaries or the log from that time in that city is that John Dee is spraying vinegar, and it is using the word like forcing vinegar up in her nose and in her mouth. They push on her stomach. Everybody, suddenly the stomach goes down. This vinegar is like being washing out her mouth and nose, as far as that's all it tells you. But it kind of sounds like something else might be occurring. And then suddenly her belly is not swollen. She says, please stop putting vinegar in my face. I don't like it. And John Dee says, she's clean. She's not possessed anymore. Let's fast forward. Because you just need to know a little bit of background here between Hartley and some of these people who are possessed. We go on to 1595, to the first of Starkey's kids that are possessed.
Did they happen at different times, or was the family sort of, were the six kids collectively possessed?
They were collectively possessed.
It happened the same time.
Yeah, it all happened really, really close together. What you come to find out as the story goes, yes, they finally work on these kids and they try to exorcise them. They call in two other priests as well. Those priests also get put in jail later, because what you find out about Hartley, after 18 months, he's been charging the family 40 shillings a year. Now he's trying to get some land out of them. All this is starting to pile up. We discover through the texts of John Dee that Hartley was kissing every one of these kids and putting the devils inside of them. So then Hartley goes to jail, found out a fraud for the Lord's Prayer not being able to say, and for kissing all the kids and putting the devil inside of them. Now Hartley's out of the picture. Hartley gets hung very quickly, hanged.
Due process.
And suddenly the kids are cured. The end.
I guess we've seen cases of mass hysteria and sort of, you know, collective behavior like that. But it is, yeah, I've never really thought of it in terms of possession. But I guess actually, I mean, that's kind of what Legion is up to, right? As far as the like, Legion by definition is plentiful. There are tons of them.
Oh, you're talking about the pigs? Legion and the pigs?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, you can read this great article by Warren Carter on cross-gendered Romans, Marx, Jesus, and Legion entering the pigs. That actually tells you Legion is not exactly literally what they say. Legion is a sort of allegory and a sort of thing for just Roman soldiers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I guess even what we talked about it before, about even just using the word pigs as these sort of outlets for Legion, even that was seemingly like a poor translation.
No, it is the translation. We're thinking of it wrong.
Oh.
So Legion entering into the pigs is more about, it can be a double meaning, can mean literal pigs, or it can be like, it's a vulgar word for vagina. And entering into is clearly, that's exactly what they mean, is what it sounds, not like a spirit entering into, but like sex.
Oh.
I couldn't think of another way to say it. And Legion referring to the Roman soldiers. So there's like a lot of word that when it becomes translated into English or into other things, it becomes like a literal, like then people interpret it literally, but it is figuratively. And we know that just because of different playwrights that were writing at that time, that that's how you use those words.
Wow.
It's a really cool article, because the story of Legion is about Jesus being this manly man and exercising his power over the Romans. Mm. And it's a huge parable about manly man conquering the Romans.
Yeah, Jesus Christ, like vampire hunter.
That's exactly. That is the story of Legion. And that's why, you know, when we talk about Mark and the way that Mark talks about Jesus' exorcisms, it's all based on this idea of Jesus is this incredible exorcist because he's this manly man. And you don't see that so much. You see kind of a softer side of Jesus if you read something like Luke, and obviously Matthew, where you see the decline kind of Jesus.
I should read the Bible more.
It's some great horror
it's like the
stories.
Original, like famous monsters of movie and screen.
Absolutely. There's some great stories there.
Something beyond comprehension is happening to a little girl on this street, in this house. A man has been sent for as a last resort to try and save her.
So that'll take us to 1973's The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it really charming that the author, William Peter Blatty, the novelist, essentially afforded to write the book by winning Groucho Marx, You Bet Your Life. And when Groucho asked him what he planned to do with the money, he said he planned to take some time off to, quote, work on a novel. And that novel was The Exorcist.
Nice.
Yeah. So the novel had a lot of heat early on. And I think William Peter Blatty always intended it for that story to be a movie. And William Friedkin is talked about how the original draft of the script didn't work. Like, he was deviating from his own novel to the extent where it wasn't really recognizable. There were gimmicky elements, mm-hmm. and we'll sort of get into the details, but The Exorcist plays like a novel. Like William Friedkin didn't want to give up that element, because sure. that believability, this world that all these, you know, crazy happenings are going to inhabit, is very lived in. It's very recognizable as mm-hmm. far as, like, you know, just dinner parties. And it was the 70s. It was a lot of socializing.
There was a lot of socializing.
Written by William Peter Blatty, based on his own novel. William Peter Blatty should be a familiar name for those. He, in addition to writing this and also the Third Exorcist and his many books, he adapted his own screenplay. And he did so in collaboration with William Friedkin and the producers. Okay, so here we go, starring Ellen Burstyn
yeah.
as the mom. Max von Sydow, who we'll get into depth there. Jason Miller, Lee J. Cobb, I found, like, oddly, he's not charming, but I liked him anyway. and then, yes, the ever-present Linda Blair.
You really don't want me to play, huh?
No, I do. Captain Howdy said no.
Captain who?
Captain Howdy.
Who's Captain Howdy?
You know, I make the questions and he does the answers.
So Max von Sydow, I thought it was... watching this movie as I don't remember when I first saw it, but you watch it and you're just like, Max von Sydow's an old guy.
I mean, because I, even thinking of him later on, I mean, he's always an old guy to me. Like, I
right,
only
yeah.
think of him as an old guy.
Yeah.
He was 44 years old.
Yeah. And so Dick Smith, who we'll talk about in more depth, was responsible for the old age makeup. And he was coming to a point where, like, he had perfected
yeah.
a certain aesthetic. Like, Dick Smith also did The Godfather mm-hmm. age makeup on Brando and
Amadeus.
He
does The Hunger. There's some
great
makeup on Hunger. Yeah.
Yeah. So Max von Sydow, present day, is the age he was playing in 1973,
so crazy
convincingly.
To me, because he yeah. looks great, and they're close shots.
I kept looking at
shots.
His hands. I kept,
yeah.
Yeah, he's got...
And he plays it so well, because when he is in Iraq, when the movie starts, and he's in Iraq, like, wandering around the ruins.
Yeah, the excavation site.
Which apparently you could just do in the 70s. Anyone could just go wandering into a thing, yeah. I guess. I don't know how that works. It seems like if there's... ancient antiquities, like, maybe people shouldn't just be able to wander.
Yeah, dudes were straight up just pickaxing the ground.
Yeah, no.
I thought it was a little indelicate, but I'm
no
not an archaeologist.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm not an expert at this. But he is so great. He's playing such, like, a frail old man, and I loved it. I think he's probably the best part about the movie.
Yeah, that opening in... Iraq, it was the last piece of the movie to be filmed, and William Friedkin had to hire an English production crew because there were still embargoes between the United States and Iraq. We see him encounter the talisman, and I don't think it ever – does it get said aloud? I don't even know why we know the word Pazuzu.
I don't know. So –
it's in
there
the
are
novel.
Certain things, yeah, exactly.
It's in the novel.
There are certain things that you just know about this movie, and then when you go back and watch it, you're like, the movie actually doesn't tell me that. There's
right.
so much
yeah.
backstory, which I'm going to just flat out say, I don't love this movie. I love a good exorcism. I love possessions. I don't love this movie, but there's so much that, like, is explained outside, or people have come to these conclusions outside, and that becomes the thing that you do or that you think about certain scenes. And if you just go by the movie at face value, half of that stuff's not there.
Yeah, I could see that. And we'll get into some of the specifics as far as, like, what is in the movie and what is deliberately edited out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I dug this. It does – it very much is a movie from the 70s. It is this paced – you know, I talked about it being novel-like, and it does cover a lot of these bases, not all of which get resolved, not all of which
right.
are really specifically addressed. Like, there are little moments, there are character moments that you don't always get in movies like this. But, like, I mentioned the Lee J. Cobb is he's the lieutenant – and, like, his character is almost superfluous to the story. Like, he's kind
yes.
of – he links a couple characters and introduces Father Karras to the story. But he, on his own, the lieutenant is such a lonely, sad guy who just needs a friend to go to the movies with.
Yeah.
And he's starstruck in front of Ellen Burstyn. Like, it's moments like that that really sell the, like, the reality.
You like movies?
Very much.
Well, I get passes to the best shows in town. Mrs. K, though, you know, she gets tired, you know, never likes to go.
It's too bad.
Yeah, I hate to go alone. You know, I love to talk film, you know, discuss, to critique. You want to see a film with me? I got passes to The Crest. It's Othello.
Who's in it?
Who's in it? Debbie Reynolds, Desdemona, and Othello, Groucho Marx. You happy?
I've seen it.
Yeah, I don't know. I could see all of that stuff being edited out of like a blockbuster sort of summer edit of a movie.
Yeah, there's a great scene between him and Karis where one of them says, you know, oh, you look like Paul Newman. And the idea is because Paul Newman was supposed to be Father Karis. He was on the list. And so it was so funny when that's like put into it. We also have a scene where even the author is in the movie for a short time. So it's like kind of throwing these little tiny things in. And to me, I think I don't actually like that. I don't think it's charming. I think, like, stick with the goddamn story. There's too much shenanigans. And you talk about these, like, realistic kind of scenes or conversations between people or sort of natural kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot between Linda Blair and Ellen Burstyn, and I just don't like it.
What don't you like about it?
I don't like the stupid everyday talking of nonsense or blah, blah about this horse. The horses. And then they like tease or whatever. And but it goes on for too long.
But without that, do you think you would feel less compelled that Reagan transforms into this demonic possessed person?
I didn't feel compelled anyway.
Oh. Oh, okay.
I have no feelings for Reagan, which is funny because as a child, I looked just like that. She's like my doppelganger.
Yeah.
And so I should have more feelings for my child doppelganger, but I don't really.
You used to use a profile picture. Was it? It was from The Exorcist 2, right?
I don't know what film it was from, but it looks just like me.
Well, then let's introduce ourselves. I'm Damien Karras.
And I'm the devil. Now kindly undo these straps.
If you're the devil, why not make the straps disappear?
That's much too vulgar a display of power, Karras.
Where's Reagan?
In here with us.
Show me Reagan and I'll loosen one of the straps.
Can you help an old altar boy, Father?
Your mother's in here with us, Karras. Would you like to leave a message? I see that she gets it.
So speaking of Jason Miller, his role, Father Karras, they entertained ideas of everyone from Al Pacino to Jack Nicholson. I thought it was funny that Jack Nicholson freaking thought was too unholy to play a priest, which
I can see that.
I think time will agree.
Yeah, I could see that. He would have, I mean, I don't think that would have been a good choice.
Yeah, but Jason Miller was like a legit New Yorker theater guy. Mm-hmm. So as far as like having the chops, it was all there. And I think he might have suffered from health problems and he died relatively young. And we talked about his son in relation to his work. I think his son was the screenwriter for The Final Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And he, in that script, he's speaking to the idea of, in that case, an actress who is typecast into the role of like scream queen and never really escapes that.
Right.
And the industry won't let her forget it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually making a comment about his own dad and the idea that Jason Miller never really blew up. He did play the Father Karras role a couple times, kind of. Reappears in The Exorcist 3, which is totally worth a watch. I think they refer to him as Patient X in that movie. And it's a relatively small moment. But that is a great sequel that has nothing to do with this original one. But yeah, Jason Miller, ever the professional, didn't need crazy on-set hysterics like William Friedkin bringing a gun to set and firing it off to startle him.
There was a lot of things where when a director resorts to absurd things like that, like slapping a priest in the face like he does at one scene and shooting a gun with blanks off in the air, like, be a better fucking director and tell these people how to act. Or have cast people who can act. If you think they can't act and they need the shenanigans, that's on you, director.
Yeah. Yeah. Famously, this film set was kind of, quote, haunted. There were a number of different, you know, tragedies that surrounded it. People got hurt. There's a part of me that wonders how much, like, the 70s and cocaine had to do with sort of people's behavior. Not that long ago, I've been watching a bunch of documentaries, Milius, the Scorsese documentary, A Decade Under the Influence, and in all these documentaries where they're talking about seminal movies, huge things, nobody talks about all the cocaine they were doing at the time and how that sort of contributed to one's judgment going into things.
Right.
And William Friedkin, I think, has also been pretty hush-hush about whatever his background is. And I'm not saying that he was a coke addict, but there was something in the air then where they were playing fast and loose. And
well, he was also
suffered the consequences.
He was also a very combative kind of guy.
Yeah.
And so there's this great story about the original composer, who was Lalo Schifrin. And Schifrin and Friedkin had worked together and hated each other. And now they're supposed to work on this. And Schifrin had composed this piece for the trailer, for the original trailer. Amazing stuff.
Six minutes of essentially preview music, what he wanted to do. Because Friedkin asked for non-music scoring, kind of heading in a direction where, say, the way Kubrick uses environments and sounds that sort of fit into that space and may or may not be part of the scene. And so it seemed like that's what he was going for. And when when Lalo Schifrin presented him with these 6 minutes of music, story goes, if one to believe the story, that he literally threw it out the window.
Which is such bullshit. I mean, I don't believe that he didn't throw it out the window. But what he does then, the studio says to Friedkin, tell Schifrin to just calm it down. Mm. And we'll still use it. Well, Friedkin wanted Schifrin out the whole time just because of previous things. They just did not get along. So Friedkin says, we're not using any of that. Goodbye. And so, and Schifrin is out now. What Friedkin does is he uses actual music pieces in the film.
Yeah.
The funny thing is the music he chooses to use he uses a lot of the Penderecki score. And the Penderecki and the Schifrin sounds exactly the same. It's like Schifrin was listening to the Penderecki and said, I'm going to just do the version of this. So it's not that Friedkin didn't like the sound of it. It's just that he didn't like Schifrin doing it.
Oh.
So we have the CSO playing some of these, which, you know, the best orchestra in the world. And they're playing the Penderecki. They're playing the cello concerto. And then there's a bunch of Webern in here. Webern's kind of a cool guy because he's so strict in the 12 tone. And so that's the piece that they're using. There are 5 pieces for orchestra, which was if I can give you an idea of Webern, early Webern is beautiful, kind of post-romantic German with a tone and a tune and all this stuff. And then, much like when Dylan meets the Beatles and then you have Rubber Soul, Webern meets Schoenberg and then Webern never looks back.
I always say that. I've always said that.
So Webern, he meets Schoenberg and then he becomes the strict 12-tone person that even Schoenberg says, maybe this is a little too serious. Berg and Schoenberg are going calm down, Webern. And Webern's no, beep, bop, boop, bop, that. So it's kind of awesome. The other thing it's kind of nice, I mean, it doesn't make me miss the Schifrin score because I love the pieces that they ended up using. But in the Japanese release, they actually use one of my most favorite pieces, which is a piece from George Crumb's Black Angels. And so that would have been really cool. I would have loved to have seen that in the American thing. I just don't think it had been kind of done by then.
Yeah, I watched the original trailer with that original music, and they made a big to-do about the test screening and how ill people were made, and supposedly people were vomiting, and it was really triggering. Okay, so a lot of that is the music, sure, but also that trailer from 73, it's epileptic seizure inducing. Mm-hmm. It's really unsettling, and in that capacity, it's really effective.
Right.
I don't know that I would necessarily want to see that movie because that seems bad news. But we do get the like ghostly image that we get frames right. of subliminally throughout the movie. And apparently that was a makeup test for what Linda Blair would come to look like as mm-hmm. far as like the darkened eyes and the pale face and the creepy teeth. And yeah, I don't know, that original trailer, I'm glad that the tone is somewhere else.
Yeah.
But yeah, really, really unsettling. We'll give a sample of the original music because it's pretty jarring and not really, you know, what we've come to associate The Exorcist music with. I guess in that sense, it's actually the Tubular Bells track
right.
from Mike Oldfield's.
I think that one's probably the most of all the songs that are in the film. It's the only one with a hummable tune. So mm-hmm. that's the one that sticks in your head.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mike Oldfield does Tubular Bells and didn't really like the way that it was put in the film.
Yeah, yeah, I read that.
Which is funny because I can't tell you anything else he's done, so maybe he should be decently grateful. Pleased with that, right?
Relatively early on, we get a taste of the effects to come. Moments like Reagan projectile vomiting on Father Karras. We've talked about how Jason Miller was put through the paces for this film and surprises that were meant to be authentic. And they were moments like projectile vomiting,
yes.
pea soup at him.
In his face.
Yeah, that wasn't part of the plan. And no. Thankfully, I guess, it only took one take, but it goes in his mouth.
It's Did all over. Did you notice over. That?
It's right in his open mouth.
I would have vomited back onto her. And then it would have been, yeah, like it would have been like Stand By Me and everyone would be vomiting.
I think that scene exists in the Leslie Nielsen movie Repossessed.
Because that's freaking gross.
It's a normal reaction to being thrown up on. Yeah. Although I will say it was straight baller when Max von Sydow, I think for his first sit down with Reagan, and he's already sort of been introduced well, where he is the elder statesman, mm-hmm. and he is unshakable, he is unflappable, even when Reagan hocks a loogie in his face.
Yeah.
That one kind of looked like tapioca pudding.
That was disgusting.
And he kind of wipes it off his face and keeps going, doesn't skip a beat.
Yeah, well, he's, you know, he's on to Pazuzu's tricks. He's done this before.
It's not the first time I've been vomited on.
The power of Christ compels you! That the power of Christ compels you!
So as far as the room set, the famous steps in Washington, D.C. are still there. And I think there is a plaque that sort of designates them, the Exorcist stairs. But most of the movie was made on a set because they had to sort of control the dynamics of like the shaking or hovering bed or Reagan sort of floating into the air. Or the freezing cold temperatures it
yeah.
took to get actors' breath to show on camera.
Yeah.
In the days before CGI, they just had to freeze everybody. That looked punishing.
Yeah, but I liked it.
Yeah.
That was like a great effect for her to walk in and then suddenly have this cold. I thought that was nice. There's really great parts to this film. I just think like overall there's things that I don't love about it. But
you think there's probably an edit, maybe a fan edit that is concise enough that you would really like.
Yeah, because I think the effects are amazing. You know, some like beautiful yeah. Character design. I think when they're not left to their own devices of ad-libbing things, then the characters stay kind of on task, and I think that's great. It's just certain other extra things that are just not necessary.
I don't always like a longer form movie, and I'm very quick to sort of point out that like this didn't need to be a feature film. Like this mm-hmm. could have been a 30-minute short. But in this case, like there's something about the dynamic, and we talked about it as it related to the editing and the possession and how that was kind of an homage to this. As far as building this atmosphere of this reality that very unrealistic things are happening in, I mean, I didn't remember very specifically, but it was a doctor who originally told the mom to seek out an exorcist. Yes. They've put her through all these tests, and like some of them are really intensive. And
dude, is that like really what you had to do to get an MRI? Because that's horrific.
It was pretty gross.
Yeah.
There was like, that weird like...
We're like, what's happening? It's like a spinal tap or something.
There was a moment where I thought I was like, we just reverted to bloodletting?
Yeah, I didn't know what was going on. I was very confused. So then, it's like a spinal tap, and then she just has to sit there and like cry. It's horrible.
And so when they've exhausted all the second and third medical opinions, and it's finally a doctor who's like...
As I said, it's a very outside chance.
Would you just name it, for God's sakes? What is it?
Do you have any religious beliefs?
No. What about your daughter? No. Why?
Have you ever heard of exorcism? Well, it's a stylized ritual in which the rabbi or the priest try to drive out the so-called invading spirit. It's been pretty much discarded these days, except by the Catholics who keep it in the closet as a sort of an embarrassment, but it has worked, in fact, although not for the reasons they think. Of course, it's purely a force of suggestion. The victim's belief in possession is what helped cause it. So in that same way, the belief in the power of exorcism can make it disappear.
You're telling me that I should take my daughter to a witch doctor.
Yeah, no. What's funny about any kind of exorcism, though, they have to go to a doctor first. It's like part of the rules.
In that same vein, I did like that Father Karras is trained as a psychologist. Mm-hmm. And he's barely still in the church. Like, he's a guy
he's
whose
not
faith
into it anymore.
Has been pushed and tested to the extent where he's just like, I'm just here for the fringe benefits.
Yeah, it seems like he does want out. He literally says, like, I want to stop doing this.
Yeah.
And they're like, go to one more. Have fun.
Yeah.
And he's like, no.
We've got a strategic means to test your faith.
Do you think I should take her to a psychiatrist?
No. I think we should wait and see what happens with the Ritalin. I think that's the answer.
The Exorcist is based on this book, which is based on a true story, much like The Possession, a true story. In 1949 in St. Louis, this all happened. And we don't actually have great accounts of everything, because now the kid who was a boy who was supposedly possessed doesn't even remember it, which is very convenient, I think.
Yeah.
It's very convenient. It's really hard to actually find anything,
or it's as if he wasn't there at all.
Maybe, probably not. But it's really hard to find almost anything about it, so you go digging in some of the religious stuff in the library, and there's like nothing. This is a tiny little blip on an insignificant scale that became huge because of The Exorcist.
Right.
You know, there's a little bit in the local newspaper about it at the time. Not exciting. It's just a kid who's acting up because he's being a brat.
Yeah, and it sounds like even the family that you described earlier, that these moments of possession are seemingly more in the style of like a Dybbuk, in terms of just, you know, it's not a demon, it's not, you know, Pazuzu, it's someone who used to have a body and doesn't anymore and is inhabiting that person, but like, it's not necessarily malicious.
Yeah.
But to turn it into a demonic being and heighten the tension that way.
It comes and goes when they feel like it, which is absurd.
Now you've got a story. Yeah.
So it's kind of like, it's one of those things where you're like, oh, I'm so excited to look into this and look into the true story. And then you find like kind of the true story and it's not worth anything. Yeah.
And I was also surprised that most of so there's a huge dichotomy between like the reports of possessions and exorcisms and the like theatrical versions and in films. And very often it seems like any cases of possessions, it's numerous visits, and it's sometimes like no progress made. Sometimes they come away with nothing. And then sometimes the person seems to be cured for good. But, but in The Exorcist, I kind of appreciate that it's not as if they come in, they have the answers, they get it done. Like they are learning step by step. And Karras the whole time is even skeptical about I'm trying to think. Oh, the reference to the mother, the famous your mother is down here with us, and he's like, how would she know my mother's dead? And has that conversation with Ellen Burstyn, but you know, he's kind of calling bullshit early on. And it's not until they want to bring in Max von Sydow as the like sort of elder, you know,
that he's like, oh, maybe something's going on here.
Yeah.
What about The Exorcist? How about Lancaster Merrin?
Lad Dawson, he was over in Iraq. I think I read that he was working on a dig near Nineveh.
Yeah, you're right, Mike, but he's finished. Came back 3 or 4 months ago. He's at Woodstock now.
Don't you think he's too old, Tom? How's his health?
Must be all right. He's still running around digging up tombs. Besides, he's had experience.
I didn't know that.
10, 12 years ago, I think, in Africa. The exorcism supposedly lasted months. I heard it damn near killed him.
Yeah, I don't know. If someone told you something that no one would know, what would you think? And they were acting like an asshole. So, and not like they're like a normal human being, but just like they're acting crazy and then they tell you something like that. What would you think?
I mean, I'd pursue that rabbit hole. I'd follow that and see just how much they know. Like, why are they throwing it in my face?
You wouldn't try and figure out, like, how did they find it? Or would you just take it as, like, face value as, like, well, you're possessed or there's a ghost in you?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, in the style of, like, the CIA collecting information, I think there's probably, like, between the stand-up comedy and social media, like, all my shit is out there.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not hard to find out. Like, if the Long Island Medium tried to do an episode, it would be pretty easy. There's a lot of, a lot of document of just whatever nonsense.
So it would have to be something like, what about that time in 1996 when you pooped your pants or something like that?
It would have to be that kind of thing where, like, the kind of shit that, like, you think about just before going to bed, something that you did that was stupid and it makes you cringe and you're like, I was 10 years old. Maybe I should give myself a pass on that one.
Mine would be like, what about that time you tripped in the cafeteria?
So I recently watched the documentary Hostage to the Devil. It's named after the book written by Malachi Martin, a one-time conservative Catholic priest and exorcist. Mm-hmm.
The church exists to answer real needs. If those needs are not answered, people simply walk away and find the answers they're looking for. And I can imagine a situation in the atmosphere of the 1970s in New York where those needs were being expressed. People were being turned away by priests, being told that we'd moved on from those old superstitions, and yet the people hadn't moved on from that sense of affliction. Now, if those people, or even one of them, presented themselves to Malachi Martin, I have no doubt that he would respond pastorally as a priest.
The church doesn't really give details on his role in the church, but he probably worked on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and he was a public personality in the style and circles of Ed and Lorraine Warren. He hated the novel The Exorcist because to him it was
nonsense.
Insulting. Yeah, it was for someone who had experienced actual exorcisms. He thought it was really, really offensive. The documentary is interesting because it does go through a number of the processes as far as like the church's opinion on it, the like the sort of 20th century surge that might have been a reaction to the liberalizing of the church. And Malachi Martin actually was really against Vatican II and the sort of softening of the church.
He made it clear that the reason why he left the Jesuit order in particular was because in the 1960s, the Jesuits, as well as a lot of other organizations back then, took a very hard left turn. And I asked him, I said, so you could say that after Vatican II, Mal, the Jesuits were in left field? And he kind of smiled and he said, no, they weren't in left field. They were outside the baseball stadium.
So that, as a character study alone, as someone who is kind of doing the like real life Max von Sydow role, that part was interesting. I don't know how much of any of it I believe, but I found it interesting.
I love reading stuff about it. Like, and I love watching, like, sometimes you can find YouTube videos, things like that. Like, I love watching that kind of stuff, and I get really scared.
Yeah, you
love
can watch the actual footage of exorcisms, and I don't really dig on that. We in the movie The Possession, when the dad is sort of doing his due diligence and researching demonic possessions or whatever, we see clips of actual exorcism performed on YouTube, and some of them look like maybe manufactured, but some of them the faces are blurred out and looks pretty fucking authentic.
Yeah, that stuff is scary stuff.
I don't like watching it.
Well, it's uncomfortable because you know that it's really probably someone who just really actually needs actual mental health care help, and people are really abusing them and abusing anyone who, you know, is taking money to do this is like also abusing the family. It's like a great fucked up thing. But I still sometimes do watch it because it's just really fascinating how the human brain like works and can manifest things. And to me, like, that is fucking crazy.
Yeah. The I guess you know what, maybe I'm skeptical because I don't want to see the real thing. But the idea that someone like a child speaking Latin or shit like that, like some language that they never spoke around the family, like moments like that are, you know, I think understandably terrifying.
I met him one afternoon and he had a fresh cut on his forehead, and I asked him what had happened, and he said he was at an exorcism and a footstool came flying through the air and hit him in the head.
Cost me a lot. Cost me two broken legs and almost broken kneecaps. And it endangered my life several times. And but I wasn't supposed to die anyway. Not yet.
While Linda Blair did receive a Best Supporting Actress nomination, it came into question because it turned out that Mercedes McCambridge did the actual voice, and what she put herself through sound nightmares as far as like chain smoking and drinking and just like scarring up her voice to do this role, and then initially not being acknowledged for it is kind of a punch to the gut. Linda Blair, even at that age, once she is, you know, acting like a possessed little girl, there is like venom in her face and malice. And sure, the voice helps and enhances that performance, but it's really that little kid pulling it off.
Yeah. I think, like, you know, watching some of that was just like, oh my God, that's what my parents like had to deal with when I would like go off on a bratty tear. It would have been like, oh my God, why does my kid look like Reagan?
Staring at the same face. That's funny. Oh, you never did a Halloween costume as Reagan?
No.
As a little kid?
But yeah, if you put my kid picture, my parents were probably just like, this is a demon. Now I have a demon for a child. And when I was being a brat, they were probably like, yup, see?
It could have only been enhanced if you had a brother who looked like Damien in The Omen. You guys would have been a great Halloween costume family. Dress as yourselves. Let's see, Jason Miller was also nominated for an Oscar for his role.
Ellen Burstyn actually was nominated for an Academy Award, but she didn't win. Ah. Jason Miller was, Linda Blair was, just not Max von Sydow. Out of the 10 Academy Award nominations, the only ones that won were the Best Sound Mixing and Best Adapted Screenplay, which makes sense because that is flawless, the voice work that's being done, the music, everything that's going on, the effects. I get that. It makes total sense. Yeah. But what's really crazy is in 1973, like, for a horror film to be up for Academy Awards is just unheard of.
Yeah, not those many ever. I got my fingers crossed that Get Out gets recognized for something this coming year. But horror usually gets the short end of the stick, and it certainly doesn't get the respect it deserves. I don't know. I thought Ellen Burstyn should have been nominated for Supporting Actress.
She's great, but I always think of her in, what is that?
Requiem for a Dream?
Yeah, that's what I always will think of her.
Yeah, that's pretty traumatic.
Aw. What's crazy, though, is for the Golden Globes, it won for Best Picture. It won for Linda Blair won.
I didn't realize that.
Screenplay won. Director won. So, I mean, there was quite a lot. And Ellen Burstyn was nominated for a Golden Globe.
Giving the people what they want.
Yeah, Max von Sydow nominated as well. So, and Linda Blair for New Star of the Year.
I wonder if that's still a thing, New Star of the Year? I don't remember a Golden Globe for that.
I've never heard of that. I don't watch those shows, though, so maybe.
Oh, everybody took the Golden Globes, but not the Oscar. Oh, okay. After the movie came out, Christian evangelicalist Billy Graham claimed that an actual demon was living in the celluloid reels of this movie. He did not have any information regarding the devil in VHS or DVD or digital distributions.
Like, my question is, did he have, like, points on this film? Because that makes you want to go see it more.
Yeah, and then when the subliminal shots of the, like, ghost-faced demon appear, like, you might piss your pants. Because you're thinking, like, it's there. Did everybody see it? And not everybody did because it's a movie theater and people blink.
Right, right.
But, there it is right there in the fringe.
It'd be really funny. Yeah, my dad, when I told him we were doing this, he was like, I remember it was so scary because it flashed on the screen, the subliminal. Or, I mean, it's not subliminal if you notice it, I guess. But pseudo-subliminal stuff, you know. And he was like, I had never seen a movie like that. And so when he saw it in the theater, like, as a kid, it was really terrifying.
Yeah, it's one of my last notes, but one of my favorite moments, and it's relatively quiet, but spoiler alert, Max von Sydow doesn't make it. When Father Karras does re-enter the room, he, you know, Von Cito had been in there alone with Reagan and suffered a heart attack and mm-hmm. died. And where Reagan has just kind of been like a loud maniac a lot of this time, when Jason Miller comes into the room, it is still, it is quiet. Reagan is sitting over Father Marin and not saying anything, just kind of like in that moment. And Jason Miller sort of, you know, realizes that like Von Cito's down for good. And it was so creepy. Mm-hmm. And Linda Blair played the shit out of that role, just as far as almost being a kid again, but in that really creepy, this demon is enjoying this too much kind of
right.
setting. It was really,
because that's his nemesis. He's already been, because, you know, Max Von Cito had already bested him once.
Yeah.
And so this was their second time around. You can't win twice. Fool me once, says Pazuzu.
And on that note, we'll head out of this episode on possessions and exorcisms.
Yeah.
We're on all the social media, so find us at Rants Macabre. Drop us a line on iTunes or Stitcher, where we reviews go a long way to helping us out. We're also on Patreon, patreon.com/rantsmacabre, where this month they got our assembled bloopers reel of some of the stuff in there is going back pretty far. But the point is, it's funny. find us on social media, drop us a line at therantsmacabre@gmail.com, and stay in touch. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.